All right, thank you, Michelle. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to this very nice meeting and really excellent talks last couple of days. Today, I want to talk to you about some very recent in-lab neutron scattering results we have on Praseodymium stannate, which is a quantum spinase candidate, and I believe this is evidence for confinement of monopoles. So there's a long list of collaborators of this project, but probably one of the most important ones is Paul Sart. So Paul is my former student. He's now gone on to work to Edinburgh, and he spent a lot of time working on the solid state chemistry of Praseodymium stannate. And I was very pleased this meeting to see people talking about defects, talking about oxygen stoichiometry, Praseodymium 3+, Praseodymium 4+, particularly with Praseodymium pyrochlorates. We spent a long time trying to figure out how to make the best Praseodymium stannate samples. And really the success is really Paul's efforts in trying to figure out the chemistry. He's now working with Paul Atfield at CSEC doing a high pressure synthesis of different pyrochlorates, but he's still doing neutron scattering with Chris Stock at Edinburgh. And we had significant input in understanding the inelastic data from Bruce Golan and Steve Nagler. So I don't have to give too large of an introduction for pyrochlorates for this meeting. They're, from a solid state chemistry perspective, they're very attractive species to study because you can substitute many different types of ions within the A or B sites, and you can still retain cubic symmetry. So they've been a really fruitful arena for looking at all sorts of different types of magnetic ground states, from spin ices to liquid, spin glosses, exotic types of magnetic ordering. And traditionally, in the past, kinetic spectral physicists have focused on the titanates, and I'm happy to see over the last decade or so they're branching out into their fields. But one of the reasons why we focus on the titanates so much is that titanium 4+ is very stable, and you can grow large stainless crystals in the image furnace. Today, we want to talk about expanding this to other types of B cations, but still focusing for rare earths on the A site. So how do chemists think about pyrochlorates in general and looking for new materials? This is what's called the pyrochlorate stability field, and there was a slide from the last presentation on this. This shows you outside this dotted line here what sort of phases are stable for ambient pressures. And this is a function of your A site cation for which is 3+ oxidation state and your B site cation, which is 4+. There's other stability fields you can make for 2+, 5+, for example. And anything outside this dotted line here can be made under ambient conditions, so you can see why pyrochlorates are studied so frequently by kinetic spectral physicists and solid-state chemists. I want to point out that the titanates stop at around samarium, right? So why does it stop around there? Why can't you make praseodymium neodymium titanate under ambient conditions? Whereas this geometric argument, which tells you, sort of empirical argument, shows you why a stability region has a sort of range. So if your A site and B site have two similar of radii, then you get this defect fluorite structure. If they're too dissimilar, if you go beyond this 1.71, the cubic structure collapses and you get monoclinic phases and there are types of low symmetry phases. I want to point out the stannates are unique in this series in that you can synthesize the whole gambit of different types of rare earths in there. So it's really a great series of compounds for looking at magnetism on the pyrochlorate lattice. Under high pressure, you can reach other phases here that are sort of metastable on the order of months to years. And actually, Alana Hallis gave a talk earlier this week. It's a picture of her doing some high pressure synthesis she was talking about last night at dinner. You can get to, for example, these phases down here. We're looking at the germinates, which are not stable. They produce actually pyrogerminate phases at ambient conditions. But under high pressure and gigapascals of pressure, you can stabilize these phases. So praseodymium stannate. So we looked at this compound over a decade ago with my former postdoc, Haidong Zhao, who's now a faculty member at University of Tennessee, Knoxville. And he published his PRL in 2008, and it's been revisited by other groups. So just want to go over the main properties of praseodymium stannate. So when originally synthesized this, it's a well-ordered pyrochlorate structure. These are all measurements on powder samples. It's hard to get stainless crystals, although there was some recent progress with flux gyros by an Oxford group, so we're looking forward to seeing what happens with stainless crystals. This is the neutron scattering data we took at NIST, so there's no new magnetic bright peaks that appear at low temperatures. However, there's a broad feature that you see in the elastic scattering. It's just integrated over this elastic line here for a very narrow window, and it has this red line here as a fit to the tube-in, tube-out structure. If you look at the crystal field excitations at higher energies, it's a well-separated, well-isolated non-Cramer's doublet. you get the right moment if you do the susceptibility measurements and a slight amount of ferromagnetism if you look at the curative ice temperature. So we dubbed this as some sort of a new spin ice. And this feature here, which originally identified as a crystal field, was actually a phonon. But the first crystal field excitation is around 210 Kelvin. So it's well separated from the ground state. Actually, there's this really nice paper by Princip et al., and I'll be quoting some of the results later on throughout this talk, where they went through and revisited our crystal field scheme and calculated J constants and such. But they identified this as a phonon when we originally identified it as a crystal field. So we called this a quantum spin ice because of the low effective moment, and we thought that it had to be driven by exchange rather than dipolar interactions. And this was really surprising to us when we first measured this at the DCS, it's a disk chopper spectrometer at NIST. We looked at the inelastic scattering. Instead of being static on the neutron timescale, we found that praseodymium stannate had this broad band of excitations. So one of my goals of this project was to reinvestigate this using high-resolution neutron scattering data to see if we can see some sort of structure in that sort of broad continuum of scattering and try to identify what that is. So I was very pleased throughout this meeting and through recent meetings we've had in frustrated magnetism to see people talking more and more about sample quality, and in particular thinking about what's actually a good power core sample, right? So it's largely been overlooked until very recently, and it's not trivial. It's especially not trivial in the case of praseodymium power cores. There are all sorts of problems. For example, you can have praseodymium 3+ or praseodymium 4+. There's problems of oxygen stoichiometry, there's problems when we get into the edge of stability and the sort of stability field. And Tyrell McQueen gave a nice talk where he talked about making very good samples of praseodymium zirconate. This is this nice paper that he put out recently where he demonstrated that you have to be very, very careful with the oxygen stoichiometry and looking at the praseodymium 3+ state. Praseodymium 3+ is green and praseodymium 4+ is black. It's one of the indicators that you have a good crystal. So in terms of the results I'm going to present today, the real breakthrough is we're working on praseodymium stannate. So these are powder samples, they're not single crystals, but we spent a long time trying to understand the chemistry and trying to get the best samples possible, and also recent advances in high-resolution neutron spectroscopy. So we revisited the inelastic scattering at CNCS. This is a chopper spectrometer, cold chopper spectrometer at Oak Ridge. And the key advantages are DCS is at higher flux and has finer energy resolution. Okay, so I'll skip to the punchline and show you what we see. So we zoomed up on that low energy scattering, and this is what we saw. So this is scattering in the powder samples at 1.65 Kelvin. So instead of having this broad feature that we saw before, we saw a hierarchy of excitations, right? So they're almost dispersionless. They don't have the right Q form factor you might expect for phonons or lattice vibrations. And originally thought this was a fluke. So what we did is we changed energy. So we went through a different incident energy going from 3.32 to 4.1 MeV. We still saw these features. We went to a different spectrometer, so we went to Sequoia. Now Sequoia is not well suited for looking at low energy excitations, but we ran in a certain mode where you can start to see these, and you can see bumps which go to a continuum to very high energy. So they're still there and they overlap with what we're seeing on CNCS. And we went to look at temperature dependence as well, right? So actually they go away at high temperatures. It's sort of a misleading scale because it's actually a log scale, but they only really become sharp when you get beneath, when we get beneath 10 Kelvin or so. Okay, so what are these excitations? So the first thing we did is we just indexed them, right? So the only thing we get to out of this plot is that we found the center of mass at each one of these excitations, and we indexed them as a function of J in terms of trying to figure out how to analyze data properly. So one of our first clues to figuring out what this data actually means is looking at temperature scale of the excitations. And what we did is we looked at our old DCS data and our recent CNCS data. We took very narrow energy integration windows looking at the elastic scattering and plotted that as a function of temperature. And then we looked at each one of these excitations and plotted on the same curve. And it appears that these excitations appear on the same temperature scale, if you like, as the elastic spin ice scattering, the diffuse scattering that we see. So we have independent measurements on different spectrometers, which show that it seems to develop on the same temperature scale. So rather than first of all describing what these are, I think it's easier to describe what they're not. So when I first saw these excitations, I thought it sort of reminded me of this, right? So this is some data from Adam Axel's group, again at Oak Ridge, where he looked at rattling of the nitrogen atoms in uranium nitride, right? So, and if you look at the data, it's this beautiful example of a quantum harmonic oscillator, I think it'd be in a textbook actually, where he sees equally spaced excitations extending all the way up to high energies. And if you do all the tests on this, you'd be fitted to the quantum harmonic oscillator very, very well. So it's a nice Nature Communications paper. Our excitations are not equally spaced in energy, actually get closer and closer in energy as you go to higher and higher energies. They don't grow in intensity as Q, so they're not, we don't think they're phonons anyway, or they're not these sort of modes that Tarl McQueen talked about for power cores. And as you increase temperature, these become higher and higher populated, right? So you can see that it shifts to higher and higher energies as you increase your temperature. We don't see their excitations just disappear as you go to higher temperatures. So we don't think that they're phonons. There are ways of getting these nice, beautiful magnetic modes in other types of frustrated systems. So Jeff Rao and other people in this room have looked at this sample, for example. So it's so-called breathing mode power core, where they have these isolated terbium 3 plus tetrahedra. And there's all sorts of different tricks you can do to get these sort of low energy excitations. And I'm happy to talk to theorists that they want to apply some of the similar tricks to our compound. But our compound has a completely different structure. And I think there's different physics from looking at different types of ions that we have. There was also a nice talk that we saw yesterday by Sylvain talking about precedating power cores and chemical disorder. So you might imagine that these are actually different modes you're seeing from a split non-Kramer's doublet, right, due to chemical disorder. One counter argument to that is that when we go to higher temperatures, these go away, right? These go away completely. We don't see them populate anymore. And if you go to higher energy, this is actually sequoia, so we counted very long sequoia. It doesn't have the same energy resolution as CNCS. What you should see this pattern repeated in higher energy crystal field excitations, and we don't see that. We see sort of a very sharp still excitation at higher energies, right? So we don't think that they're due to, solely due to split crystal field excitations. So how do we analyze our data? Well, we took some inspiration from Radu's work. So this is cobalt niobate data, and so it's a 1D ising ferromagnet of a TC around 3 Kelvin or so. So I have these nice cobalt chains, and if you look at the inelastic neutron scattering spectra, you get these nice dispersions, but then you get these other modes that you see on top of there, which get closer and closer to energy to each other as you go to higher and higher energies until they eventually break down into a continuum. So what's actually happening? What's the physics of this? Well, these are excitations you're seeing between spin defects, right? So it's a so-called Zeeman ladder problem. And Radu spent a long time thinking about this, and he has this very nice science paper where he can fit and simulate this entire spectrum. So one of the questions I want to ask is, can we apply this model towards our quantum spin ice, where we have a linear potential between the spin defects, and can we get the same sort of excitations? So how do you map this problem onto the spin ice problem? Well, in spin ice, the defects are splintlet excitations, right? So they're essentially the quasiparticles. So what I believe we're actually seeing is some sort of interactions between the between different quasiparticles in praseodymium stannate. There's a tension between them, which you can sort of think of as a Dirac string tension. If you don't like Dirac strings, you think about some sort of interaction energy between the defects. Mm-hmm. But that's what I think that we're seeing. Now, there is an energy cost for splitting the spins, which is similar to the energy cost for this 1D Ising model that I presented before. And there's also linear potential that we'll have to justify in the end. But how well does this model work? So Radu's worked this out, and people have worked it out before. I'm looking at other systems as well. What's nice about this is that you can solve the Schrodinger equation exactly here. So you have an effective reduced mass between the monopoles. This is your linear potential. X is the distance between the monopoles. And 2E0 is the energy cost for creating them. So the exact solutions are negative zeros of the Airy function, which gives you these energy eigenvalues here. So you have a cost of E0 for creating your monopole excitations, and E Z sub J's are the negative zeros of the Airy function. So lambda is your tension, if you like, they come out as linear potential model, and mu is your effective mass of your monopoles. So you saw our bound kink states in Radu's model for his 1D system appear below a threshold of 2E0 for creating 2 spin flips, and we'll have to have a similar sort of energy scale for our spin ice. So how well does our model fit? So here's the fit to our data. So you're looking at you're applying this equation here, basically your energy versus your negative zeros Airy function when you've parameterized your excitations here. What can you get out of this fit? Well, the intercept tells you about the energy cost for creating spin flips. This is within error of zero, although there's an error bar on here, right? And it can be very negligible, especially if you have quantum fluctuations for creating these excitations here, but it's a very, very small energy for creating the defects. From the slope, if you have an estimate of your effective mass, if you like, you can calculate your lambda, which you can think about as your string tension. So how do we calculate?
Yeah. This plot is what temperature?
This plot's at base temperature. It's at 1.65. So if you measure the higher temperatures, I mean, even if they get 10 Kelvin, they're really, really weak. I mean, you can sort of, but the slope does change, but it's not really physically meaningful, I think, to fit at those higher temperatures. You can only pull out a few excitations in there. They're very, very broad.
So have the temperature dependent down there?
We do, but again, I wouldn't put a lot of stock into that because you only have 1.65 and 10 Kelvin, right? So we don't have, that'd be nice to measure that in the future, I agree. So if you want to measure a sort of a tension, if you'd like, you need an estimate of your effective mass of the excitations here. And so there's this work by Pandol where he did this for ytterbium titanate, so you can translate that over to praseodymium stannate. So you need an estimate of the transverse term of J, which actually we have from this Princip paper where they revisited the crystal field scheme, looking at the midnight properties of this. You have your lattice constant, alpha is a constant in the order of one. So if you get your slope and extract and put in your effective mass of the monopole defects, you get this value for your lambda. So it's roughly 0.13 MeV per angstrom. So as a sanity check, as a consistency check, does this make sense for sort of an energy scale with respect for some sort of string tension or some interaction between these monopoles? Well, it depends upon the average string length, right? So that potential is also proportional to x. So it's fortunately, we have the wave functions for this, so it's an exactly solvable Schrodinger equation. So this is what you get for the average distance, if you'd like, between these defects here. So it scales like your Z sub J. So you can look at your different excitations and you can figure out what's the average distance between those. On CNCS, we measured up to the Z sub J roughly of 7.94. We plug that number and you get around 10 angstroms, right? So these are defects that don't propagate very far. Now we have seen higher order excitations on Sequoia, which is roughly twice this, but that only gets you to roughly 20 angstroms or so, right? So these defects don't make it very far, the monopoles don't make it very far, only one or two unit cells before they annihilate. So the maximum energy scale for excitations is roughly 1 MeV or so, so 14 Kelvin or less. So you put in 20 angstroms, you can imagine roughly twice that energy scale here. But this is sort of consistent with the last talk where you sort of looked at what sort of bandwidth do you have for the excitations. It's on this energy scale here that you'd have. So that's sort of what you'd expect. So one of the questions you might be asking yourself is, why hasn't this been seen before? Why haven't we seen these excitations? And people looked at spin ices for a long time. Well, I think we sort of have a natural explanation for that if you apply this model towards dipolar spin ices. So Bruce and other people have spent a long time thinking about looking for monopoles and looking at very low energy excitations in holmium titanate and dysprosium titanate. And in those cases, the monopoles are essentially deconfined. Right, so they're deconfined. Your string tension, if you like, if there is an effective tension, its lambda term is very low, it's effectively zero. And what happens to your plot there is that everything collapses on the elastic line. Right, so actually everything's buried within this elastic window. Now, Yixi Soch showed some data yesterday where he's maybe seen something coming out of there at very low energies in order of like the micro EV scale here. But if you apply this model towards dipolar spin ices, everything should collapse within the scale here. So we have a natural explanation for why in quantum spin ices you can see these monopoles here within this model and you can't see it for dipolar spin ices. And it's very difficult to resolve those excitations at all. So it appears that in quantum spin ices, there is a slight amount of confinement if you believe this model, and that's the reason why we can see the excitations. Another question you might be asking yourself is, why don't we see this in praseodymium zirconate or praseodymium hafnate? So there's some very nice data that's been presented over the last few days on different praseodymium pyrochlores, and Tyrell McQueen and Colin Berlmaner has been working on, for example, praseodymium zirconate, where they have this beautiful periodic that came out recently, an energy communications paper before that, where we saw these well-defined excitations at very low energy that have characteristic Q dependence, but they haven't analyzed or they don't see the same type of data that we see. So from a chemistry perspective, I'd be asking, maybe when I look at these problems and I think about disorder, right? If you compare zirconium 4+, compared to tin 4+, the radius is much larger. It doesn't look like much larger, but in solid-state chemistry terms, it is much larger. So what you would expect is that the zirconium 4+ is similar to size, more similar to praseodymium 3+, compared to tin 4+, so you expect there to be more AB site mixing. Now, it's fortunate that Leon Balance and others are working on models right now which show you that even if you have a chemical disorder in quantum spin ices, you get this mysterious Coulomb spin liquid phase, quantum spin liquid phase. And I believe that's what Colin and others are seeing. But our system could be different because we have very little disorder, right? So it could be a very different situation. So just to summarize, we recently seen some low-energy excitations in praseodymium stannate. I believe these are interactions of Munsemann defects, which in language of quantum spin ice would be interactions between magnetic monopoles. If this is true, I think this would be the first spectroscopic measurement of the confinement to magnetic monopoles and the first measurement of some sort of a Dirac string tension. An estimate of tension is roughly 0.13 MeV per angstrom, which gives you an energy scale of roughly 10 to 14 Kelvin or so. But there's still unresolved issues, right? So why is it different than prestinium zirconate? Why is it different than prestinium hafnate? And obviously, I think in the future, we'll need to look at crystals of prestinium standing. There's an Oxford group that's working on these, and I look forward to seeing what the results are of those measurements. So this has been recently submitted to Nature Physics by Paul Sart. So with that, I'd like to thank the many people that have contributed towards my work over the years, various experimental facilities, my funding, and you for your attention. Right. And you see a dispersion right there, and you see some sort of interaction you can see there.
So I wonder if there's some sort of frozen elastic component that exists in this compound.
I don't have an answer to that, but I mean, what I can say is that these peaks are not resolution limited, right? So there could be some dispersion there. These are powder samples here, so there could be something more complicated going on there. I'll talk about interactions, but I mean, they look sharp here, but they're not resolution limited actually on CNCS. There could be some structure in there. There's no, I'm looking for a theory input for that. We don't have a good explanation for why there's linear potential. You can imagine the 1D chain that there are spin flips, and there's a better model for that. But I'm not sure why linear potential works so well. Or short distances, you can imagine as a perturbation, linear perturbation works pretty well, but it's still a complicated problem.
Where is the peak in the specific heat in prestinium standing?
It is.
And the specific heat.
I've noticed that about you. Is that working? So that's a C over T, right? So it's very low. Actually, sorry, I can't read in that scale here, but it's anywhere of like a Kelvin or so.
So at 1.5, you're in a regime where you have lots of topological defects.
Right.
So did you try, one can try to estimate the bifocal screening length?
I haven't done that, but that could be a reason why it's a short range.
Yeah. Well, it'd be this confined in, it'd be screened at large end scale.
I agree, yeah.
So, I'm not sure if confining potential would survive, but the interaction sounds a bit big. I mean, better than Tom.
Normally, like in the bait, and then also in the, there's some cobalt compounds that also show boundment like this. So in these compounds, there's a temperature dependence because the binding energy changes with temperature. And normally, it actually only appears below ordering, you need that mechanism. And there should be a temperature dependence which shows up as a shifting of the peak position.
Right, so they do shift with it's hard to see on here, but we fit that, so that was a question that Michelle was asking too. We have fit this, there is temperature dependence, here's the data here.
So it's
really hard to see, it's not log scale, but they are shifting, right? You can barely see my tens. It's a log scale, so it's really misleading, but they are shifting.
But 10 Kelvin is really high temperature.
It's where we start to see diffuse scattering, though. So you're just barely starting getting into that quantum standard state. Bruce has seen diffuse scattering, like holmium titanate, dysprosium titanate, like 20 Kelvin or so, but it's extremely weak. But
it never really goes away, right?
Right. So. Yeah.
What is the energy for crystal field level?
The crystal field levels?
Yeah, the first one.
The first, it's 200 Kelvin, and it's very high. That's the first crystal field there.
What's the Q dependence of those modes?
The Q dependence, so you can see here, so it's sort of broadly peaked at around, just over one inverse angstrom or so. So they're not like phonons, right? They don't grow with Q. They appear to mimic the elastic line.
Do you have an estimate on how much oxygen vacancies you have?
We do. I can talk to you about chemistry later. We spend a lot of time talking about it. So it's in the order of like a few percent.
So do you try to anneal them and see if these models disappear? Or?
We haven't. We unintentionally annealed the sample. We destroyed it doing a pressure sample, or a pressure experiment, but a completely different sample. But we haven't done those experiments. this data took several days of counting for each one of these temperatures. Just to give you an idea, weak. It was a large sample, and it was like 10 grams or so. So it's an extremely weak signal.
Jeff and then Radu.
So for a non-Kramer system like this, you wouldn't expect the neutron to couple to spin flip excitations like pairs of monopoles. So how sort of how are you supposed to even see these at all in the system?
It's a complicated question, right? I don't understand how you can couple those. Again, it's similar to the last talk, right? Where we saw similar stations, right?
Maybe related, but more experimental question. Do these respond to magnetic field?
It's a good question. So we planned to do an experiment, but we never finished it. But that would be really interesting to see how the tension changes, right? Because they should shift in energy. By one Tesla or so, the sample orders. And we only have powder samples, so you can imagine, unless you have some sort of a line sample, it'd be hard to really measure that properly.
So you said you apply a one Tesla field.
If you apply one Tesla field, it orders. So sample, yeah. So if you go to the, here I can show you. We haven't done neutron scattering. Well, we do neutron scattering to show that there's an all and out structure develops by one Tesla or so. But you recover a lot of your entropy by one Tesla. It's an all in all out entropy next structure that develops by one Tesla.
Well, that's on powders. That's
on powders, right.
Fields aren't polarized.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So it's complicated. You really need to see on crystals, right? So there's an Oxford group. It's a Boothroyd group. They're growing them right now.
How do you know it's or not? Just refining the
just refining it, yeah. But again,
best structure? I'm
not confident about that because it's neutron scattering in a field on powders, right? So unless you can hold the powders rigidly in place. We think it's the all-in-out structure, but we haven't published that yet.
Colin and then Sylvain?
This is another kind of very naughty possible explanation for it, which is that if you had some sort of lattice instability, which would define a number of different regime sites, then you could expect to kind of just split the doublet into several different.
And right.
That would be really nasty.
Yeah,
how does the temperature come in for that?
So that would be structural transition, some sort of local structure.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So something in the elastic structural scattering.
So I can show you what happens when we try to put disorder in, and we try to. So we've intentionally tried to put disorder in. It's a different project, but by doping with titanium 4+, so it's adding chemical pressure, but we've actually put titanium 4+ on the B site, and what happens is your elastic scattering immediately goes away, and then you get this broad distribution of crystal fields. Even putting a few percent in, this is actually 40% response, even put a few percent in, you never get these sharp modes. You just get a broad distribution when you start putting disorder in, even at the few percent level.
Mm-hmm. That looks very similar to prism.
That's right. Yeah, you did the Fjost. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So how intense are those modes? Like, I mean,
how intense are
in terms of some rules or how much scattering comes from those?
Oh, I haven't integrated. That's a good question. You can integrate and figure out what the moment is, right? We haven't done that. Yeah.
So this is the question.
I was wondering why these modes are so flat because.
It's a good question. It should be dispersion.
There is still a dispersion.
Yes.
In the longitudinal direction of the chains. So if you take the power average of that, it should be completely blurred. Well, I don't understand how it can be. Where is the dispersion in some sense of the?
Right. So they're not like what you'd expect, right? So, but these are not resolution limited. There could be dispersion here. So if you look at, like Oleg's theory calculations, for example, where you look at Dirac strings, right? There could be some dispersion here. They're not resolution limited. They're rather broad. Even on CNCS, these are not resolution limited, right? And some of them have different widths, right? So there could be some dispersion buried in there, I completely agree. And there should be some dispersion.
So you showed some higher energy data that has some extra peaks higher up?
These ones, yeah. Yeah, so there's some extra peaks that extend all the way up here.
So in your plot of how the energies vary, How do these extra peaks that do?
So these get closer and closer in energy. By the time you get up here, you have so many peaks overlapping, we didn't include that data. I can show you some data later if you want to see how they correspond there. But by the time you get to Sequoia, does not have great energy resolution there. It's not designed for low energies at all. But these are all overlapping by the time you get up here. You're into your continuum states here, so it's hard to resolve them. So we didn't include it in our paper. We just want to see if they were there.
Your theoretical model predicts their overlapping?
Yes, yeah, yeah. So if we fit these low temperature peaks and then index them, you can see that they're all overlapped up there. If you just plug in your lambda value.
So the lowest energy peak in your Sequoia data is at about 2.5 MeV?
What are some peaks down here? Yeah, so these are near around two or so. Yeah.
And you don't see it in the powder integrated.
Well, you can see something over here, right?
Yeah, but
you can't see it.
If it's there, then there seems to be some energy level above which they just suddenly get much less intense, right? Because they're all about the same intensity in a minute.
We do not have a quantitative calculation intensity dependence of the excitations yet, so we're hoping that we simulate theory calculations for that.
Just, is there any possibility to have, let's say, excitations among the excited crystal field states, which are very low energy and just
I don't think so. So that's originally, so I approached this problem. I was interested in disorder. What happens when you put disorder and can we make an ordered power chloride? And that ordered power chloride was the excitations here. So I was very interested in the crystal field excitations, but we don't see any of these modes around these higher energy crystal fields. And there's nothing else down there. Crystal fields have been worked out so by the people as well, not just us.
I mean, if there was some sort of very large unit cell that was appearing, they wouldn't have to impact all of the crystal field levels in the same way.
You're right. You're right. There could be some selection rule there or something. Yeah. So that'd be interesting. The problem is getting this resolution on these peaks at high energies. It gets harder and harder. But you're right. It could be.
You showed the 70 milliwave data. What is in the energy transfer 70 milliwave? What's the resolution about? Even if there will be an explaining, you will not be able to say it, yes.
What's our resolution on what? I'm sorry? On this? Yeah, so I mean, you should barely see some of these out here. You start to see something in here, but if you fit this, it looks very regular, right? It's like all, yeah. You're right, that's a hard problem, right? Getting this energy resolution on these peaks is a hard problem, right? It doesn't rule out this completely.
Okay, I think we're going to have to stop because we're late. So let's thank Chris for.